Chapter 22. That instant of profound calm, the shadows on the brick deck became as still as the men. "You think not?" said Lingard, thoughtfully. Carter nodded. He resented the turn of the incident, and the growing impulse to surrender to that man. "Mrs. Travers trusts me, though," went on Lingard with gentle triumph, as if advancing an unanswerable argument. "So she says," grunted Carter. "I warned her. She's a baby. They're all as innocent as babies there. And you know it. And I know it. I've heard of your kind. You would dump the lot of us overboard, if it served your turn. That's what I think. And that's all." Carter nodded slightly and looked away. There was a silence. Lingard's eyes traveled over the brig. The lighted part of the vessel appeared in bright and wavering detail, walled and canopied by the night. He felt a light breath on his face. The air was stirring, but the shallows, silent and lost in the darkness, gave no sound of life. This stillness oppressed Lingard. The world of his endeavors and his hopes seemed dead, seemed gone. His desire existed homeless in the obscurity that had devoured his corner of the sea, this stretch of the coast, his certitude of success. And here in the midst of what was the domain of his adventurous soul, there was a lost youngster ready to shoot him on suspicion of some extravagant treachery. Came ready to shoot. That's good too. He was too weary to laugh, and perhaps too sad. Also the danger of the pistol shot, which he believed real, the young Arash, irritated him. The night and the spot were full of contradictions. It was impossible to say who in this shadowy warfare was to be an enemy, and who were the allies. So close were the contacts issuing from this complication of a yachting voyage, that he seemed to have them all within his breast. Shoot me. He is quite up to that trick, damn him. Yet I would trust him sooner than any man in that yacht. Such were his thoughts, while he looked at Carter, who was biting his lips, in the vexation of the long silence. When they spoke again to each other, they talked soberly, with a sense of relief, as if they had come into cool air from an overheated room, and when Carter, dismissed, went into his boat, he had practically agreed to the line of action traced by Lingard for the crew of the yacht. He had agreed, as if in implicit confidence. It was one of the absurdities of the situation which had to be accepted, and could never be understood. "Do I talk straight now?" had asked Lingard. "It seems straight enough," assented Carter with an air of reserve. "I will work with you so far anyhow." "Mrs. Travers trusts me," remarked Lingard again. "By the Lord Harry!" cried Carter, giving way suddenly to some latent conviction. I was warning her against you. Say, Captain, you are a devil of a man. How did you manage it?" "I trusted her," said Lingard. "Did you?" cried the amazed Carter. "When? How? Where?" "You know too much already," retorted Lingard, quietly. "W waste no time. I will be after you." Carter whistled low. "There's a pair of you, I can't make out," he called back, hurrying over the side. Shaw took this opportunity to approach. "Beginning with hesitation, colon a word with you, sir," the mate went on to say. "He was a respectable man." He delivered himself in a ringing, unsteady voice. "He was married, he had children, he abhorred illegality." The light played about his obese figure. He had flung his mushroom hat on the deck. He was not afraid to speak the truth. The gray mustache stood out aggressively. His glances were uneasy. He pressed his hands to his stomach convulsively, opened his thick, short arms wide, wished it to be understood he had been chief officer of home ships, with a spotless character, and he hoped to light up to his work. He was a peaceable man, none more. Disposed to stretch a point, when it came to a difference with niggers of some kind, they had to be taught manners and reason, and he was not averse at a pinch to, but here were white people, gentlemen, ladies, not to speak of the crew. He had never spoken to a superior like this before, and this was prudence, his conviction, a point of view, a point of principle, a conscious superiority and a burst of resentment hoarded through years against all the successive and unsatisfactory captains of his existence. There never had been such an opportunity to show he could not be put upon. He had one of them on a string, and he was going to lead him a dance. There was courage too, in it, since he believed himself fallen unawares into the clutches of a particularly desperate man, and beyond the reach of law. A certain small amount of calculation entered the audacity of his remonstrance. Perhaps it flashed upon him the odds gentry will hear I stood up for them. This could conceivably be of advantage to a man who wanted a lift in the world. Owner of a yacht badly scared a gentleman money nothing to him. Thereupon Shaw declared with heat that he couldn't be an accessory either after or before the fact. Those that never went home who had nothing to go to perhaps, he interjected, hurriedly, could do as they liked. He couldn't. He had a wife, a family, a little house paid for with difficulty. He followed the sea respectably out and home, all regular, not vagabonding here and there, chumming with the first nigger that came along, and laying traps for his betters. One of the two flare bearers sighted his elbow, and shifted his weight to the other foot. These two had been keeping so perfectly still, that the movement was as startling as if a statue had changed its pose. After looking at the offender with cold malevolence, Shaw went on to speak of law courts, of trials, and of the liberty of the subject. Then he pointed out the certitude, and the inconvenience of being found out, affecting for the moment the dispassionateness of wisdom. There will be 15 years in gaol at the end of this job for everybody, said Shaw, and I have a boy that don't know his father yet. Fine things for him to learn when he grows up. The innocent are dead certain here to catch it along with you. The missus will break her heart, unless she starves first. Home sold up. He saw a mysterious iniquity in a dangerous relation to himself, and began to lose his head. What he really wanted, was to have his existence left intact, for his own cherishing and pride. It was a moral aspiration. But in his alarm the native grossness of his nature came clattering out like a devil out of a trap. He would blow the gaff, split, give away the whole show, he would back up honest people, kiss the book, say what he thought, let all the world know. And when he paused to draw breath, all around him was silent and still. Before the impetus of that respectable passion his words were scattered like chaff driven by a gale, and rushed headlong into the night of the shallows. And in the great obscurity, imperturbable, it heard him say he ashed his hands of everything. And the brig? Asked Lingard, suddenly. Shaw was checked. For a second the seaman in him instinctively admitted the claim of the ship. The brig. The brig. She's right enough. He mumbled. He had nothing to say against the brig, not he. She wasn't like the big ships he was used to, but of her kind the best craft he ever. And with a brusque return upon himself, he protested that he had been decoyed on board under false pretenses. It was as bad as being shanghaied when in liquor. It was upon his soul. And into a craft next thing to a pirate. That was the name for it, or his own name was not Shaw. He said this glaring owlishly. Lingard, perfectly still and mute, bore the blows without a sign. The silly fuss of that man seared his very soul. There was no end to this plague of fools coming to him from the forgotten ends of the earth. A fellow like that could not be told. No one could be told. Blind they came, and blind they would go out. He admitted reluctantly, but without doubt, that as if pushed by a force from outside he would have to try and save two of them. To this end he foresaw the probable need of leaving his brig for a time. He would have to leave her with that man. The mate. He had engaged him himself to make his insurance valid to be able sometimes, to speak to have near him. Who would have believed such a fool man could exist on the face of the sea? Who? Leave the brig with him. The brig. Ever since sunset, the breeze kept off by the heat of the day had been trying to re-establish in the darkness its sway over the shoals. Its approaches had been heard in the night, its patient murmurs, its foiled sighs. But now a surprisingly heavy puff came in a free rush as if, far away there to the northward, the last defense of the calm had been victoriously carried. The flames borne downstream bluishly, horizontal and noisy at the end of tall sticks, like fluttering pennants. And behold, the shadows on the deck went mad and jostled each other, as if trying to escape from a doomed craft. The darkness, held up dome-like by the brilliant glare, seemed to tumble headlong upon the brig in an overwhelming downfall. The men stood swaying, as if ready to fall under the ruins of a black and noiseless disaster. The blurred outlines of the brig, the masts, the rigging, seemed to shudder in the terror of coming extinction, and then the darkness leaped upward again. The shadows returned to their places. The men were seen distinct, swarthy, with calm faces, with glittering eyeballs. The destruction in the breath had passed, was gone. A discord of three voices raised together in a drawling wail trailed on the sudden immobility of the air. Brig ahoy! Give us a rope! The first boatload from the yacht emerged floating slowly into the pool of purple light wavering round the brig on the black water. Two men squeezed in the bows pulled uncomfortably. In the middle, on a heap of seamen's canvas bags, another sat, insecure, propped with both arms, stiff-legged, angularly helpless. The light from the poop brought everything out in lurid detail, and the boat floating slowly toward the brig had a suspicious and pitiful aspect. The shabby load lumbering her looked somehow as if it had been stolen by those men who resembled castaways. In the stern sheets, Carter, standing up, steered with his leg. He had a smile of youthful sarcasm. "Here they are," he cried to Lingard. "You've got your own way, Captain. I thought I had better come myself with the first precious lot, pull around the stern." "The brig's on the swing," interrupted Lingard. Aye. "We'll try not to smash the brig. We would be lost indeed, if fend off there, John. Fend off, old reliable, if you care a pin for your salty hide." "I like the old chap," he said, when he stood by Lingard's side looking down at the boat which was being rapidly cleared by whites and Malays working shoulder to shoulder in silence. I like him. He don't belong to that yachting lot either. They picked him up on the road somewhere. Look at the old dog carved out of a ship's timber, as talkative as a fish, grim as a gutted wreck. That's the man for me. All the others there are married, or going to be, or ought to be, or sorry they ain't. Every man jack of them has a petticoat in tow, dash me. Never heard in all my travels such a jabber about wives and kids. Hurry up with your dunnage below there." I had no difficulty in getting them to clear out from the yacht. They never saw a pair of gents stolen before, you understand. It upset all their little notions of what a stranding means, hereabouts. Not that mine aren't mixed a bit, too, and yet I've seen a thing or two. His excitement was revealed in this boyish impulse to talk. "Look," he said, pointing at the growing pile of bags and bedding on the brig's quarter deck. "Look. Don't they mean to sleep soft, and dream of home maybe? Home. Think of that, Captain. These chaps can't get clear away from it. It isn't like you and me." Lingard made a movement. "I ran away myself when so high. My old man's a Trinity pilot. That's a job worth staying at home for. Mother writes sometimes, but they can't miss me much. There's 14 of us altogether, 8 at home yet. No fear of the old country ever getting undermanned, let die who must. Only let it be a fair game, Captain. Let's have a fair show." Lingard assured him briefly he should have it. That was the very reason he wanted the yacht's crew in the brig, he added. Then, quiet and grave, he inquired whether that pistol was still in Carter's pocket. "Never mind that," said the young man, hurriedly. "I remember who began. To be shot at wouldn't rile me so much it's being threatened. Don't you see, that was heavy on my chest. Last night is very far off, So and I will be hanged, if I know what I meant exactly when I took the old thing from its nail. There. More I can't say till all settled one way or another. Will that do? Flushing brick red, he suspended his judgment, and stayed his hand with the generosity of youth. Apparently it suited lingered, to be reprieved in that form. He bowed his head slowly. It would do. To leave his life to that youngster's ignorance seemed to redress the balance of his mind against a lot of secret intentions. It was distasteful and bitter as an expiation should be. He also held a life in his hand, a life, and many deaths besides, but these were like one single feather in the scales of his conscience. That he should feel so was unavoidable, because his strength would at no price permit itself to be wasted. It would not be, and there was an end of it. All he could do, was to throw in another risk into the sea of risks. Thus was he enabled to recognize, that a drop of water in the ocean makes a great difference. His very desire, unconquered, but exiled, had left the place, where he could constantly hear its voice. He saw it, he saw himself, the past, the future, he saw it all, shifting and indistinct like those shapes the strained eye of a wanderer outlines in darker strokes upon the face of the night. X, when Lingard went to his boat to follow Carter, who had gone back to the yacht, was up, mast and sail on shoulder, preceded him down the ladder. The old man leaped in smartly, and busied himself in getting the dinghy ready for his commander. In that little boat Lingard was accustomed to traverse the shallows alone. As he had a short mast and a lug sail, carried to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.